Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 9. But first, as usual, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Srikwamukulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Shwakopmek people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, if you love to travel and you love to cook and you love hanging out in natural environments, it might be said the world's your oyster. In the 21st century, you can travel just about anywhere you like. You can cook anything you like for yourself or for others. And you can explore and appreciate the wonder and beauty of all sorts of natural ecosystems. But there can be a point where you say it's time to put down roots to create a structure for your life and that takes your aspirations into account, but gives you a material base as well. Today's guest is someone who embodies these aspirations and has now reached the point in her life where it's time to bring them together and create her own enterprise in her own way. Ashley Rutherford is the owner-operator of Gnomnivore Kitchen, a unique and whimsically named food business inspired, as its website says, by a passion to create quality fare that didn't come at the cost of our planet or the expense of one's health. Not only that, but also a very human goal is there to bring out the excitement that food ignites within us. So without further ado, a warm welcome to Food Conversations, Ashley.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Did that sound like you?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. Now, as listeners will learn, you've had a long and winding road. Food preparation in the world of hospitality goes all the way back to your childhood. So I'm minded of a story you have on your website about a backyard treat session for imaginary guests. Would you tell listeners what was that all about?
Of course. So when it would rain, there'd be a part of our yard that would puddle and pool with water. And I would love to go out and splash in it as any kid would, but more often than not, I'd find myself having make-believe food sessions.
Dinner parties. Welcome all.
You know, I'd have my cups and I'd be filling a bit of plant litter and things that had washed up, and then I'd be pouring a little bit of water over the top, and that would be my gravy. So in my mind, I was making chips and gravy.
Yes. Which later became one of your favorite foods.
Yeah.
And would you say, here's your cup of tea to the imaginary guest and serve them? Well, I wish we could all have been there. Now, as listeners can tell from your accent, you've come to Canada from down under, from Australia. You and an awful lot of Australians love to travel. I often thought it was a rite of passage. If you lived in Australia at some point when you were in your early part of your life, you'd head off. There were physiotherapists and occupational therapists at the hospital. Is that something that's a little bit of a cultural maneuver that goes on in Oz?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say not everybody. Some Aussies are quite happy to be in Australia. You know, they found their comfort zone, and that's totally okay. Mm. But I do think that travel is a big part of the Australian culture, you know, especially when you've got places like New Zealand or Bali and Indonesia, just to skip across the ocean. You
know? Well, your family did a lot of traveling in Australia. I mean, it's a pretty big country. People don't always, the way the Mercator projection looks, it doesn't always look how huge it is, but there's some measurements I looked up. You started in Perth in the western coast, and then this big city, 2.3 million inhabitants. Then you went 3,000 kilometers north to a little town called Wyndham, and then you went east to the Sunshine Coast on the east coast near the ocean, over 4,300 kilometers from Perth, ending up a little town there called Palmwoods. And just by comparison, the distance from Perth to Brisbane, the coast, is about the same as from Vancouver to Montreal. So it's just a little bit less big than Canada, which you always think of as being pretty huge. Now, Perth is where you started off. Big city. What do you remember about a big city when you were growing up? Because now you're in a little town. What was it like in a big city?
I remember it was busy. With big cities come a lot of people in traffic.
Was that, by the way, that was before your serving to imaginary guests, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We always sort of lived in the smaller suburbs outside of the city. But one thing I do remember, actually, I believe it's King's Park. So just to the side of the city center, across the river to the south, was this big grassy park. And we would go there when they'd put on big outdoor theater movies. Mm. So we'd be sitting, you know, bring a picnic. The big screen and projector is set up. And we have this view over the city and over the river. And as it turned dark, all the lights would come on and it would get twinkly. And that was a real treat for us.
Lovely. A very sensory, enriched sensory experience. Now, from there, Perth, this big city, you went almost due north, pretty much the edge of the continent, frankly, a little farther than you would have been in the ocean, to this little town called Wyndham, with about 670 inhabitants, right on the ocean's edge, or close to the ocean, a big inlet there. What kind of memories? This is a big transition for a family, going from, even if you're in a suburb of a big city, you're surrounded by busyness, and suddenly you're in this little town on the north edge of the country. What do you remember about that transition?
Yeah, so I first there was just space. The expanse of space and the sound of nature, I think, was really prominent. You know, going to sleep at night, there wasn't cars going by the house. There wasn't all that noise outside the window. And it was just a lot of fun. When I think back to that time, I remember a lot of the adventures and outdoor explorations that we would do as a family unit. My dad was our bushman. So he was always, you know, out there on the water. You know, we had a little yacht for a period of time.
How big was your yacht? Big enough for four
footer.
People.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a decent size. Yeah. Seven, no. Probably not a 7 meter.
Maybe a 14 footer. It was small.
I was going to say, very intimate. Yes. You didn't want to jump overboard because it'd be hard to find you. One of the things that I found out about that little town was that there was this unbelievably beautiful bird that was really its center of its habitat is there. It's called the Gouldian finch, a typical European, you know, trait. We name a bird in Australia, where Aborigines have lived for thousands of years, after this guy named it after his wife. But the bird this is radio, folks, so you won't be able to see it, but I can tell you, just listen to the colors. It's got a purple breast, a yellow abdomen, bright yellow, bright purple, a bright green back, a blue fringe around its head, and then its face, if you can call it that, is either yellow, red, or black. I couldn't help think this is something where Mother Nature had a palette of paint left over and she just kind of winged it together. Do you remember ever seeing one there? I know you looked it up after we chatted before the show, but...
No. No, if I did, it's not something that I remembered.
It was way off in the distance. Yeah,
they're vibrant. They're gorgeous.
Quite amazing. Now, the town is near a long passage in from the ocean, hot and dry, but also floods and major downpours. What was it like for a kid? I remember being excited by thunderstorms. Were you... What were they like? I mean, were you scared, or was it just something?
There could have been a little fear, but mostly it was excitement. We would first feel the coolness come, see the dark clouds on the horizon, and then the electricity in the air. My sister and I would be dancing in the thunderstorms in our backyard with lightning forking over the top of us, thunder rolling around us. That was just what you did in a thunderstorm.
Yeah, well, they are quite spectacular. And you could see them coming, which is another thing. You could see them kind of moving in.
And if I can just mention one thing, the storms wouldn't always pass through town. And so my parents would sometimes find storms on the radar, and then we would drive out of town to this kind of little isolated storm pouring down, come back to town absolutely drenched, and everybody's really confused, you know, thinking we've been to the pool or something.
Well, my mother used to chase fires in Vancouver, so I think there's something exciting about the phenomena of the natural world, they really are quite, they just can be overtaking you without you realizing it. Then you moved from that side of the country, well, that end of the country, depending how you look at it, right over to the eastern coast, to a little town called Palm Woods, near to what's called the Sunshine Coast. There's the Sunshine Coast here in BC, of course, but
that's right.
Very similar. It's next to the ocean, very kind of holiday, you know, tourist kind of place. What was that like for you? This is your third place that you've lived in. How did it compare to the other two?
It was fancy. It felt fancy. We had access to the beach, you know, the salt water, the waves. The hinterland was a 20-minute drive. Well, actually, where we were in Palm Woods, it was a 10-minute drive. We were right at the base of the hinterland. We could go from freshwater swimming holes and waterfalls out to the beach within about 25 minutes. And it was quite well populated, so there was always something for us to do.
Now, it's maybe not unusual for every family, but it's a bit unusual to be traveling all over the country. And that was, I think, had to do with your mom and your dad. Your father was a teacher and your mom was a midwife. What was it like having parents who were involved in services, you know, trying to help people? I mean, you're surrounded by it. I guess you just don't notice it's just what mom and dad are like. But still, do you think that's had a role to play in the way you've looked at the world?
Yeah. Yeah, it has. And I think that was really important to our parents growing up, that not just seeing that, you know, they would bring home stories about their day. But that was something they instilled in us too. And I think having that essence of giving back or being of service is a large part of what was instilled in me and my siblings growing up.
They also encourage you to travel and to see the world. I think that's this Australian cultural thing, but also for them, it was something that was important. They wanted you to get out and see things.
Mm, yeah.
You also did some cooking with your mother. And we'll talk about some family recipes here. The famous Staffordshire oatcakes.
Yeah.
What's it all about? What's a Staffordshire oatcake?
So a Staffordshire oatcake is different. I need to distinguish from the Scottish oatcake, which is more like a hard kind of a scone thing. But the Staffordshire oatcake is from the UK, and it's more of a hearty, savory, thin crepe. But it would be made out of oats and yeast, and it was a risen thing.
Yep.
And every Christmas Eve, we would make this Staffordshire oatcake and cook up a sausage, a barbecue sausage, and we would roll the sausage inside this oatcake, sprinkle it with cheese, and bake it in the oven. And we would eat that dish one day a year.
I'm just going to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Ashley Rutherford, who's the owner-operator of Nomnivore Kitchen. Now, it does sound delicious. Even though we're vegetarians now, I remember eating an awful lot of meat when I was a kid, and I could see that that would be very yummy. But there were also some attempts at veggie cooking, and one of them, which was a bit of a breakthrough, some of it you said was a little bit horrible, but there was one that was a real success, and that was Italian meatballs.
Mm-hmm.
What are vegetarian Italian meatballs?
Yeah, so as I like to call them, neat balls. yeah, they are... They're using oats. So I love oats in cooking. They're great. They're nourishing. They've got a lot of, you know, healthy aspects to them.
That's right.
And so, yeah, spices, oats, onions, breadcrumbs, these oat balls would fry up and then finish cooking in a nice, rich tomato sauce as a kid. And even as an adult, you know, I would be hard-pressed to be able to tell the difference between them if I didn't know any better.
I think you'd actually pulled the wool over the eyes of one of your family members.
I did. I had an ex-boyfriend that we used to feed this dish to when he would come over for family dinners, and he was a big meat eater. Vegetarian wasn't really on his radar, and we would trick him. And to this day, I'm sure he still doesn't know that he wasn't eating meat when he would have that dish.
Well, we won't tell him. And if he's not listening to our show, he'll never know. Now, your mom actually at one point, even though she was a midwife, she really wanted to have a little eatery of her own.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think she was longing for that? Or I mean, she was obviously a midwife. She was very, and rose up in the ranks of midwifery to become, you know, kind of a senior person in the field.
Yeah, the director of the department.
But she obviously inculcated a little idea about an eatery. Because, in fact, when you started working after school, one of the places you worked was a family restaurant in Palm Woods, right in this little town you're living in. And you did you worked at the whole gamut of employment in that place. What was that like? What was this? It was opening up a world for you.
I found it to be a good balance of challenge and enjoyment. At that time, yeah, I guess something came alive inside of me and I suddenly had interest and drive and I wanted to see what I was capable of. Mm. And so, you know, it was a juice bar as well and an ice cream place and a cafe and we did food and I worked my way into all of those positions up to part managing that with the
barista, waitress, bartender, you wrote some of these things down. Barista, waitress, bartender, cook, dishwasher, supervisor, co-manager.
Yeah.
So you worked your way through all of the... Was that because the owners were pretty open when they saw somebody who was eager and willing to work? They sort of took you in. They said, okay, let's do everything.
I'm not sure if it started out like that completely. The owner and I would work a lot of shifts together in the kitchen. And over that time, we formed a bit of a bond. And maybe it was me sort of strong-arming, hey, I'm worth trusting. Give me a shot.
Yeah. But then she must have, your boss must, he or she, must have learned that you meant it.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't just, you know, flaunting sort of an idea. You were actually willing to put the work in to do it.
Yeah.
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 It's an important thing. You even at one point were picking mushrooms, wildcrafting a few mushrooms for the kitchen.
Yeah. That wasn't so much connected to that job and it wasn't glamorous and it was not outdoors.
Oh, really?
There were these big inside grow rooms with multi levels going up.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
We would spend 10 hours a day getting absolutely dirty head to toe, you know, on little stools or big ladders, harvesting mushrooms that were growing.
Did you ever hear about the fact that because they produce a lot of carbon dioxide, it can sometimes be dangerous, so sort of the ground level? You didn't hear that?
No, and that's the place I was situated.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad you were rescued by the fate from that.
Yeah.
There were some deaths here in British Columbia of mushroom pickers working in large-scale growing operations. And actually, there's a company in Salmon Arm here that is making robotic mushroom harvesting machines so that nobody has to die of asphyxia, which
wow.
is...
Wow. Well, so, I had no idea.
Retroactive anxiety is now you're a lot at this point. Then you got to the point at one stage where you actually wanted to buy the restaurant if you'd had large pile of dough sitting waiting for you to do it with. Which brings us into an issue that's come up a number of times on Food Conversations, and that is the difference between sort of intellectual understanding and hands-on understanding. What you said on the website, or some comments you made, learning from the university of life experiences, learning by doing. Now, one part of that is mentorship. You know, you find people who can support you, like your boss who said, well, you know, we struck up a relationship and you said you want to do it. And she'd say, okay, go ahead. She trusted you to do that.
Yeah.
Did you have along the way people who have been those kind of people for you, who in some place of employment or some place where you had committed yourself for some time, that would say, okay, I'll show you how to do this, or this is what you need to know. This is how you cut through all that, you know, dross and get to the heart of the matter. Did you have people like that?
I did. Yeah, just the place we were talking about in Australia, that was a really great environment. And I've even been lucky enough to have that here in Canada. Mm. So back in Alberta, yeah. But more than the support, it's been the opposite. you know, and it's been learning through the things that I thought I would like to get, but the reality was it was the hard lessons and figuring out a lot on my own.
Sure. So do you try something and didn't work, or you would meet somebody who would, was, you had to kind of adapt to their thorny personalities or something like that? That's often, yes, in the food industry. That can be an issue. Yeah.
Yes. And I think I had such a great experience, you know, when I was very young, I just thought everybody would be open to wanting to help and mentor, but that wasn't the case. And I did have some really difficult bosses that, yeah, you know, really challenged me, and just, it taught me to stand on my own two feet and to learn how management and the food and beverage industry works. Mm-hmm. Through my own experience.
Do you think it was harder because you were a woman and, you know, there's this classic, you know, old-fashioned, you know, I'm a man, I know what I'm doing, and you're a woman, you don't, or I can order you around, that kind of thing?
You make me think of exactly one person. That's, I did feel very challenged by in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Male chauvinist.
Mm.
Yes.
I wouldn't change it, though, I'll tell you that. That has really built me.
Yes.
To be stronger.
You know that if you let that kind of person push you around, that it's going to be bad for you, for sure. And it's not going to be good for them either, because they're just, you know, people won't want to be with them and work with them. Mm. Now, moving on from the real life learning of hands-on skills, there is also a lot of traveling. You took the injunction from your parents seriously.
I did.
And you enjoyed it. And there's a list of places you went to. You mentioned one: Bali, Thailand, New Zealand, Europe, Africa, United Kingdom, Sri Lanka, United States, and of course, Canada. Why don't you just give us a couple of words about each of those places and how they shape you as a person or your created experiences for you? So Bali's a kind of touristy kind of place. Was that a touristy thing?
It was a family holiday. And I just remember green rice paddy fields
everywhere,
and cows in our hotel backyard.
That's a good place to have them. If they're producing milk, you've got something to go for. Thailand. What was Thailand like?
Busy, very busy. A lot of traffic, a lot of chaos. I just remember the roads sort of had a traffic going in one direction and the other direction.
Yes.
But it was one for all, you know, within that direction. There was no... No rhyme or reason.
Chaos. Wonderful chaos. Thing in traffic. New Zealand.
Mm.
What were
beaches.
You there for?
Beaches. I was there with a friend. It was a summer holiday. Yeah. We were both in high school. And she took me, her and her family, for 1 month for a family wedding.
Is that a typical thing between Australia and New Zealand, that you know, sort of back and forth visits are pretty common?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know when Jacinda Ardern was Prime Minister of New Zealand, there was their opening policy event, and it was on Facebook, and all the comments down the side, can we have a Prime Minister like her, please? she was something special. Europe? You went to Europe?
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about?
Europe was just for the exploring, for the food, for the fun. Romania is one of the places that I went with a cousin who had made friends with someone who had a hostel. And so there was a lot of, sorry, mum and dad, but hitchhiking in a foreign country going on there. But my cousin, a big Australian man that no one would want to mess with, I felt very safe and we had a really good time.
Yes, it's good to have a bodyguard once in a while. And then you tootled down through Africa. What was that all about?
That was a last minute trip. So that was during a Spain holiday, and we were right down at the southern point having lunch one day, and we could see Morocco across the Mediterranean Ocean. Yeah, and yeah. My partner and I decided that we could not go on until we made that side trip. We were so close. We just had to.
You zoomed over, said, hi, Africa, and away you went.
Yeah, we spent 5 nights there.
You went to Britain. The colonial hub of Canada and Australia and New Zealand and a few other places. What was that, again, just a visit, or were you actually looking around?
A visit. Yeah. Our family history comes, my mum's side comes from Britain.
Did you visit some of those places where she came from?
No, I did not. But my sister was living there at the time.
She hitchhiked and she didn't go and see your home.
Yeah, bad daughter. My sister was living there. She'd lived there for 10 years. So it was, a nice reunion.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Sri Lanka.
Love Sri Lanka. That had been on my radar for a few years. And I had been looking at doing some sort of volunteer work with elephants or learn to surf on the coast. But that hadn't happened. And it was after my first couple of years in Canada going back to Australia. Mm. And I found a way to have a stop off in Sri Lanka and finally get to visit that country.
What was it that drew you to Sri Lanka?
I couldn't tell you. Maybe I'd come across a photograph years
ancient
ago.
Ancient histories connecting to a past life. Heaven only knows. Well, then Canada, this country drew you in. What was it about Canada? Because this is where you really started to get serious about not just traveling around visiting, but what was it about coming to this country that was different for you?
At that point, I realized that as I was only getting older, I was going to be running out of time if I ever wanted to experience living and working outside of Australia. And Canada was just the one that fit the bill for me. It had the seasons, it had the outdoor adventure. And so that really pulled me. Mm. And it was the best decision I could have made, I think.
Well, we're very happy to hear that. Speaking as Canadians. Just remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Ashley Rutherford, who's the owner-operator of Nomnivore Kitchen. So Canada, and you started in Alberta. Now that's an interesting destination. Did you look at all of Canada, or did you just, there was something available in Alberta that you wanted to go to?
It was something being available.
Yeah.
And I took the cheap road the first time. Well, not necessarily the cheap road, but the easy road, whereas I had a company helping me do the transition from Australia to Canada. Sure. And so they're the ones that put on my radar a job that was available, three jobs, but I looked into all of them and it was in Jasper. So my first job that I held for the 2 years when I came here was at the Fairmont Jasper Park Lodge.
Pretty posh. You went right to the top of the ladder in terms of food, expensive food service. And you also met Winter. Winter, for somebody from Australia, must be a little bit of a rude shock. I think there was a burgeoning desire to move to a slightly less cold place that sprang up relatively quickly in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Especially when Canada sort of became more of a longer plan.
Mm.
Yes, I needed the sunshine.
That's where you met Cedric.
We did in Jasper, yes.
Now, he was in the training program to be a chef at that time, or was he about to do that?
Yeah, he'd come to the Fairmonts during his process to get his Red Seal. Yeah. Mm. So in his mind, he was going to be in every food department and do every position and, do his schooling on the side and learn it all.
All that stuff. The whole process of getting into Canada ended up being rather complicated. I think you applied to come just before they changed an age preference. But also, you'd met Cedric. You started up a serious relationship, and then you ended up going back to Australia for a couple of years because of the way the rules worked. Why did that happen? Not exactly a wonderful idea.
No, but the reason it happened was because my sister decided to get married. And if I didn't have to leave Canada, I could have stayed in Canada while getting my residency. However, because I left the country, I wasn't able to get back into Canada now that my visa had run out.
There was no way you could say, it's my sister getting married, she's my only sister.
Make an exception for me. No.
So once you walk outside the borders of Canada, you are now having to start sort of all over again.
Yeah, and I could have come back to Canada, but not to work.
Oh.
Yeah. So I could have touristed and vacationed, but I wasn't legally able to work, and so the appeal was not there.
did anybody explain that to you, why that happened? It seems like either misguided or cruel and inhuman.
No, I was aware of it. And in the months leading up to the date that my work visa had run out, and then the next month, my sister's wedding in Spain, I was looking at everything, what avenues I could take, how I could make it work, but I just wasn't able to.
Good Lord. Mm-mm. Good Lord. I mean, by this time, you and Cedric were an item, and it was like very bad circumstance. What was it like when you finally crossed, well, I guess you crossed the Pacific at that point. You weren't crossing the Atlantic. What was it like coming back to Canada, to Cedric, to, you know, where you'd really, your heart was really located? It was quite something.
Yeah, it was a really nice reunion.
You appreciate somebody if you've been pulled away from them for a couple of years. Now, Cedric is a French-Canadian, Canadien Français, and his background in his younger years was in Quebec family cuisine. Cuisine familiale québécoise. We lived in Montreal for 7 years, and it is a different kind of cuisine. It's a different world. But he got his final Red Seal certification in 2020. What's he brought to you and food and the way of looking at the world and the role that food plays?
So much. He is just a wealth of knowledge, and he has a true passion for food as well. And so he's bought me companionship. You know,
you don't have to be the only foodie in the crowd. No. There can be two of you together.
You know, we'll have a lot of fun discussing recipes and cooking meals for each other. I'd like to focus more on cooking meals with each other, but that's another thing on the list. Indeed. That we can get around to. No, but I trust, you know, absolutely, when there's something that I'm not sure, especially through the business, just going to Cedric and, hey, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, such and such, or, you know, yeah, he's great.
On the website you have, it says that Cedric's inspired by the energy and experimentation that went on in the kitchen and the ability to create moments of joy and comfort. That's really enriching the whole place of food in our lives. It's not just a nutrition, you know, source of nutrition and energy and that kind of stuff, but it's a social experience, which plays into all the things that you said about your connection to food. And you mentioned, I remember early on in our conversation, having fun, and having fun when you're working hard is the best kind of fun, it seems to me. So that notion of experimentation and joy and comfort, how's that go down with you? Central?
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, to some people, cooking's a chore. To me, it's a way I wind down at the end of a day. It's something that I can do in the middle of my day if I just want to have a good time, put some music on.
The other place you like to wind down is in your garden. What's the difference between your garden and cooking in terms of winding down? I just made that question up.
That's a good question. The difference, I guess it's the stages. So when I'm cooking, I have the food and I'm figuring about how to put it together. When I'm in my garden, I'm watching that food grow and I'm learning about what's involved, you know, from the seed or the seedling to the mature plant. And it's quite fascinating.
And the garden's alive too. With food, you're hopefully not cooking things that are especially animals. But it is a different world. You're in the company of living creatures.
Yeah.
Living plants.
And watching, you know, my plants getting bigger and watching flowers turn into buds, turning into vegetables it's just very rewarding.
Now, at a certain point, the intimidating effect of Alberta winters got through to you and Cedric, and you said, we have to get out of that kind of weather experience. So you started to, as you called it, doing your homework. You did your homework. You said, oh, where could we go? So how did your homework go? What was it? You read books, you talked to people, you looked at atlases, you looked at weather charts.
Yeah, there was a bit of looking at the weather patterns over the year, Google mapping. We were lucky enough that we would be able to go in person. Mm. And a lot of the time it wasn't like, oh, we're going to drive 9 hours this way to go and check out a place we might want to live at. Mm. But it would be during vacations and road trips and sure. some of these places that we really were considering, mm-hmm. you know, we'd spent time and driven through and right. yeah.
So what was about this part of the world?
Mm. It's bountiful. It's beautiful. It's got mountains. It has lakes, trails, and the food.
The food?
The food.
What? Tell us on Food Conversations about the food in Salmon Arm.
Just the amount of fresh produce that comes out of the region mm. was super appealing to us. And I've only been learning more just how much, you know, with the different farmers and the meat, and there's just so much mm. and so much care and love that's going into all the small, you know, businesses, and it's just appealing to us yeah. because where we can, we definitely prefer to buy from them.
Absolutely. And that's in fact one of the pillars of the business you've started up here, Nomnivore Kitchen. Let's get right down to it. Let's talk about how we got gnomes into the picture of the food creation that you're working on. You brought a book today.
I did.
What's the book?
The book is called Gnomes.
Yes.
It's from 1976. And it originated all the way in the Netherlands. This book is something from Cedric's childhood. Mm-hmm. And it is a very true fictional work about the ins and outs, the life of the gnome.
The gnome. The gnome in your life.
So Gnomnivore, it's a blend of two words, gnome and omnivore. Eating food and eating all kinds of food is who we are mm. and what we do. But we believe by doing so in a sustainable manner is going to be the way that we want to go mm. forward, the way, you know, we want to approach things, and especially with our business. And I guess Cedric had a moment of inspiration after going through this book. and he was the one that actually came up with the name.
Well, it just goes to show you may be raised in one language, but you can do something very imaginative in another. Mm-hmm. you moved here in March of 2023. And on your website, speaking of just going back to gnomes for a second, you have a little line there. It says, what's the name mean? And under, you know, frequently asked question, it says, good question. Wouldn't you like to gnome?
Yes.
And then you add a line, fun-loving fellows who have plenty to teach us in terms of enjoying fair food and respecting the land and all its inhabitants. And just to make sure that people don't make a mistake, there's a picture of a gnome meditating, literally with his arms outstretched in the garden.
That's right.
showing us all the way. So if we're not sure what to do next, that's our inspiration. When you started your food business, there was what you mentioned earlier, something more than just producing food or selling food. You said, it's somewhat poignant, you said somewhere along the line, the human body plus nourriture, the French word for food, but it's got a broader implication. It's nourishment as well. that connection has faltered, just like our symbiotic relationship with the earth. What's embedded in that phrase or that sentence?
Well, when I look around at what's available today, I see a lot of convenience, but it doesn't necessarily equate to health. And it's just that, it's convenience. I really appreciate some of the small businesses in Seminar and around this region who are offering food that is not only convenient, but is also nourishing. And I believe in that. I think it's important that, you know, we're paying attention to what it is we're putting in our bodies, because to me, food is medicine, and we can keep ourselves healthy just by being mindful of what our diet looks like. And if that's, you know, a train that's coming by me, I want to jump on that train and I want to be a part of this movement that's helping people.
Your timing couldn't be better, because that's the way much of the change in food, growing food, distributing food, eating food, preparing food, that's where it's going, towards health and also towards a sustainable planet, which is the underlying process that we all have to work for. Just to remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Ashley Rutherford, who's the owner-operator of Nomnivore Kitchen. Now, this isn't, in terms of your business, this isn't just talk. This is something you've tried to build into the structure of what you're doing. For example, you purchase as much of the food as you can from local businesses, and you have a list of them on your website, and some of them I know are just down the road from where you live. You work on, as a result, keeping money in the community, so it's not going to some offshore money bank, and then work on lowering your carbon footprint. One of the ways you're doing that is packaging. Packaging you paid a lot of attention to. Why don't you describe what you've done with respect to packaging to make it live lightly on the planet?
Yeah. So we currently have been using a vacuum seal bag, which, of course, yes, it's plastic, but I'm super aware that it's wonderful. The recycling program here has just started a few years back, well, probably 5 or 6 years now, the flexible plastic program.
Right.
So, you know, what we're packaging our food in is able to go not just into landfill. It now has an option to go further and become part of that circular recycling initiative. We have just purchased a bagasse bowl. And so we're going to be, it's a sugar cane.
It's the fiber from sugar cane stems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's actually disease. If you breathe a lot of dust in the field from harvesting sugar cane, you can get bagassosis or something like that.
And it's, no.
Yes. But you don't get it when you're using it.
Get it if you're eating
it.
No,
absolutely. No. You're safe. Everybody's safe.
No, but they're a really nice plant fiber alternative, you know, and it's naturally water and oil resistant, and it can go in the freezer and not get
brittle
and break
down. Where did you
find
out about that? You must have been hunting around.
Oh, scouring the internet. Yeah. I was just having a look at what's available.
Sure.
You know, and we're very lucky because there is a lot of options out there being created, whether it's bamboo or the bagasse like we've got.
For years, it was just thrown out or burned off sugar plantations. It was just considered to be waste.
Yeah. Crazy. Now it's actually being put to something good.
Yeah.
And it breaks down easily, too. It can be composted.
So that's something that isn't part of food, but it is part of what the food industry or the food profession or the food world does. And single-use plastic being chucked is almost a hallmark, especially of food that brings in not just nutritional value, but also the convenience if you order food out or whatever like that. So it's about time lots of people started thinking like you are thinking. Now, your menu is conditioned by a number of factors. Duck meat plays an important role in what you started to do so far. How did that happen?
For our love of duck. Cedric and I have been together back to Quebec to visit the family and take vacations. And one thing we both love about going through their supermarkets is the readily availability of duck. And we just noticed that that wasn't something that we could find here. And yeah, we thought, why not? We're going to make it available here.
How are people responding? It's not commonly served, but it's certainly, I mean, I had a grandfather who used to go out and to a nature reserve and shoot ducks, which I didn't particularly think was always the best way to do it. But duck meat with lead pellets was occasionally served in his home. You're supposed to spit out the lead pellets. I'm not recommending that to anybody, just in case anybody's listening about that. But how is the public
responding
to that?
It's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
There are some people who are just a little bit put off by it. Every now and then we will have samples of our duck pastrami, which is one of the products that we do. And I've been surprised, you know, we've been a lot of firsts for people who have never had duck before. Hunting. So when people think of duck and eating duck, they're referring to their experiences of wild duck.
Yes.
And maybe that hasn't always been enjoyed. Where we're sourcing our duck from is ethically raised on a farm out of Chilliwack. It's completely different. Yes. I believe it's a different taste profile.
And it's also a different world. It's a different worldview that's underlying it. It's instead of being, you know, macho fellows out with shotguns, you know, blowing little birds out of the air, it's people raising them in a congenial kind of manner and harvesting them, you know, killing them sustainably and humanely, which is a huge difference. You also get cheese curds. You get cheese curds locally. Where do the cheese curds come from?
Down in Armstrong.
From?
The village cheese.
The village cheesemaker, yes. Yeah. What else do you, and you've gone back to the mushroom world of only this time. It's not in a giant mushroom factory. You've actually been foraging some.
Yeah.
What's that like, wandering around the countryside picking up mushrooms?
I absolutely love it. Ticks all the boxes for me. And I just feel so grateful that I've been able to meet friends, who I consider a friend now, who have the skills and the knowledge. And so I've tagged along and I've been learning and having a lot of fun, you know, identifying the mushrooms, learning about the habitats that they grow in and the areas.
It's an art form. Harvesting mushrooms is a bit of an art form. You have to know lots of different things that end up telling you where mushrooms are easily found. And good mushrooms, yeah. Also, you have other things like beer in your food. And you have gluten-free, you have dairy-free, you have vegetarian. So you've been, it seems to me you're putting a lot of thought into, I mean, I'm sure these days people are starting to do this all over the place, but you're putting a lot of thought into what's in your food and how you prepare it and how you divide it up into this category or that category.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, who creates the menus in this giant operation?
We both have been.
Do you test them out on each other?
Yeah, there's been a lot of home testing. Yeah. we've both been involved in the recipe creating. And of course, there's a lot of discussion that happens prior to actually going ahead and deciding, oh, this is a good reason to do this one.
An important place for you guys is the Zest Food Hub. What would your work be, your business be, if there was no Zest Food Hub in this area? How would things change for you?
I don't even know if we would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not the first person to say that, by the way. That was kind of a trick question. Because other people have said, Without the zest, we would never have had the temerity to plunge in. So what is the zest for you? What does it give to your work?
It gives us opportunity. It gives us a place to start, a place to create. And I love the zest. It's so well equipped. Mm-hmm. And it enables us to do what we do. It enables us as a small business, you know, starting out with a small budget, to begin something legit and real.
And you meet other people doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of a community there.
There is
a little bit.
Yeah, there is.
Now, your food now is available from a whole bunch of farmers markets. The list on your website is quite long, and it covers, you know, from Salmonham down to Vernon and from Kamloops over to, how far do you go over?
To Revelstoke.
Yeah, Revelstoke, it's a bit of traveling there.
Yeah.
You like traveling? Well, you've got to travel.
So we are coming up to 1 year of being in business. And this past year back in 2024 was all about research and understanding how our food and our concept goes in different areas around the region. And so, yeah, there was a lot of travel and there was a lot of markets. This year, however, I feel like we're still going to be refining that a little bit more as we've really found the places that welcomed us and receive us well. Yeah,
there are always, in this kind of situation and at the stage you're at, of course, there are always bound to be lessons learned. You think something's a good idea and it isn't, something doesn't seem that great. And next thing you know, it's central to what you're doing. Yeah. Now, you're also planning on a next phase as a result of this thought and this experimentation planning. What's your next phase going to be?
Yeah, so our next phase is going to be branching out into wholesome meals.
Like the meal, all the meal.
The whole meal, yeah, exactly. So it'll just be a little bowl full of yummy goodness.
Experimentally proven.
Yeah.
You mentioned some recipes that you have in mind. They sound quite yummy.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you give the listeners a little taste?
Absolutely.
Precarious taste of their...
So our first three to come out of the gate will be a honey mustard chicken bowl with the herb mashed potato and vegetables. We will be doing a sweet and sour pork bowls with a nice brown rice and quinoa blend with vegetables.
And
our Italian neat bowls. So this is our vegetarian bowl. Mm. Yeah, with a nice mash and veggies.
This is a full circle situation, isn't it? Persuading somebody that they're eating meat as a young person. Well, you're a young person still, but a little bit younger then.
Yeah.
And now you've turned this into a specific kind of art form. On your website, there's so many words like enjoyment, laughter, gratitude. There's a sentence at the end of your comments. You said, "I have so much gratitude for this planet I live on. I know it's worth protecting, so I'll continue to learn ways in which I can contribute to making my little piece of paradise better for the whole." That's pretty expansive. That's pretty, I don't know, in tune with the values that we all are starting to learn to create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
It's really been a delight to have you on the show. You know, you're at the beginning of an enterprise, but it's not really a beginning because you're bringing together all sorts of insights and experiences to put them at service of what is really the whole of the rest of humanity and planet Earth. I don't think there's any better way that you could be doing things when you're starting up a business. It's sort of heading in the direction where the future inevitably has to go.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you're really good about this.
I do. And the best part is that, you know, it really feels like it's a piece of me, you know, and I'm not just figuring out what this business is going to look like and how I want to run it. But, you know, I'm also figuring out who I am in the process, you know, and what's important to me. And it's really, I feel so lucky that I have the opportunity to merge these things together and bring it to life here.
Well, I think Sam and Arm is lucky to have you and Cedric here doing that. It's enriching the community. Thank you very much. And it's delightful to have you on the show, Ashley.
Thank you so much.